Hello and welcome all of you to Awaken Talks this morning. Good morning and good evening to everyone, depending on which part of the world you are joining from. My name is Rahul. Thank you for joining us today. The purpose of Awaken Talks is to plant seeds for a compassionate society. And while we are all on our inner and outer journeys, these calls help us hold space for our guests who come from all walks of life and who inspire us to offer ourselves in service. Behind each call, there is a whole team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows for the space to manifest. Today, our guest is Aurelio Hammer, founder of Swaram and based out of the Orable community. The call will be moderated by Nisha. Thank you all for joining today's call. We would like to start the conversation with silence to anchor ourselves in the space of the present moment. I invite all of you to join in for a minute of silence. Welcome again to our fortnightly Awaken Talks. In conversation with Aurelio C. Hammer is Nisha Srinivasan today. In a few minutes, we will be handing it over to Nisha, who will introduce the talk theme and then dive into the interview, which is titled, Listening to Our Inner Music. Today, our moderator is Nisha, who has catalyzed many lives gently, inspiring many through her life choices and experiments. And now we have one of our friends, Shabbar from Hyderabad Unheard Space, to offer her introduction. Over to you, Shabbar.
Thanks, Rahul, for providing me an opportunity to introduce Nisha. Good morning. Or good evening, friends. In my humble opinion, we can know a person through these three lenses. The first lens is one's inner journey he or she has taken, how one has participated in the growth of the family, and the impact he or she has created on the world. I have known Nisha for the last 7 years. Let me share some stories which tells about her. So around 7 years back, Nisha visited Hyderabad to meet one of her common acquaintance. There she met my brother Abid. Abid said, my brother has done some experiment in growing fruit trees. And since Nisha is like very close to natural farming and trees and all. So although I was not there at home, or neither my family, they visited my house. And there were some vegetable beds which were about to start. And to my surprise, when I came back, I saw the vegetable beds were prepared. This was done when she has not known me, hardly knew my brother. It was really, really surprising for me. And it tells a lot about her character. Second story is like a few months later after this, we went to Nisha's farm in Coimbatore. We got a game for Nisha's son, Om. And it was morning 9 a.m. Om insisted to Nisha that, okay, why don't you play with me this new game? And house was full of guests, and I could see so much of work which is pending. But to my surprise, Nisha sat with Om and played the game for 30 minutes. This was shocking. But later I realized the best gift you can give as a parent to a child is attention and time. A few years later, this is the third story. A few years later, Nisha and Raghu came to Hyderabad to have a one-day nature cure camp. The camp started and the camp was hacked for health. The camp's preparation started from 4 a.m. in the morning and it was going till 11 in the night. In the middle of this camp, Suchitra said, Nisha, is it possible next day tomorrow to address a gathering for an hour? And I knew that Nisha's next day was packed. They were supposed to go back to Coimbatore and they were like physically tired like anything. But without a thought, she said, let me try to squeeze it. This was her dedication to the community. This is what Nisha to me. They left so-called comfortable life in Silicon Valley to a remote village in Coimbatore to live a life which is in harmony with nature in every pretty much every dimension. And in this process, inspired so many like me. Thank you so much, Nisha. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Shabbar, for joining from Hyderabad. and telling us about all these stories we would have probably not known, because as we know, Nisha, Raghu and Om kind of live under the radar, doing and planting all these acts of kindness. And even before we know, they have kind of blossomed into some beautiful trees. Thank you, Shabar. And now moving on to our guest of the day, Aurelio, who at a very short notice accepted this invite and graced this gathering with his presence. Born in Austria, Aurelio's love affair with music began on the guitar when he was 12. By 19, Aurelio was well trained to play classical compositions. But he says that whatever I played, I could not make music of the heart. So keen on learning indigenous music from various parts of the world, he left home at 19, went to remote islands, etc. His journey took him to a lot of distant places when he was still in college. Following a mystical experience, he arrived in Pondicherry in 1980 and stayed there for a few months. Pondicherry beckoned him again in 1991, and Aurelio moved to the township of Auroville. He's been involving himself in community outreach programs for children, organizing and being a part of performing arts, theater. He also then found his true calling as he began a journey into sound, both personal and institutional journey, converged, that saw him first found a cultural center called Mohanam in 2002, and then later in 2003, Swaram. Swaram, founded by Aurelio, its motive is to explore the role of traditional musical instruments and the physical, emotional, social, and environmental impact of sound on human psyche. Swaram is not just a musical instruments manufacturing and research facility. It actually grew out of a social development and vocational training project. It generates livelihood for over 40 people, amongst them former construction workers, car mechanics, school dropouts from neighboring villages around Auroville. Swaram also explores the study of using sound for healing and well-being and tackling the complex phenomenon of body pain. So welcome, Aurelio, who describes himself a listening soul following mysterious song lines into unknown territories. And yet his diverse interests converge together harmoniously in his life as he awaits a new music on earth that will reflect humankind's evolution into a new integral consciousness. Welcome, Aurelio, and over to you, Nisha.
Thank you so much, Rahul, and thank you so much, Shabar. I'm just so grateful to be spending this weekend with you all. And it's such a joy to be conversing with Aurelio, who has made it his life endeavor, our sadhana, to be in tune with so many inner and outer vibrations. And when Rahul was introducing Aurelio, that here's a person who has in one lifetime or even half a lifetime lived so many lives so deeply. And I'm humbled by that. Thank you so much for being here, Aurelio. And I know it's going to be difficult to cover so many aspects of your life that you have lived so richly in just 90 minutes, but we are going to try anyways. And the broad themes that we would like to explore today are how may we deeply listen to our inner music? And how does one integrate disparate aspects like art and music, social action, spirituality, and business in one's life without being spread too thin? And what is the secret sauce to the unity of our human race? So those are some broad themes that we'll be exploring today. And before that, we always start our talks with a chant and our music, and to vibrate us in the frequency of the inner light, today I invite Shalini Srinivasan, also from Oroville. And Shalini moved to Oroville 4 years ago, leaving a very vibrant career in media. And she's a mother to a young girl of 12. And now she has taken up volunteering in Oroville full time, and she teaches at a school and also focuses on her own inner growth. And Shalini, it's a blessing to be hearing you today. Thank you.
Thank you, Nisha, Aurelio, Rahul, everyone, all the volunteers. Agnirmevachi shritah vaghridaye hridayam mayi aham amrite amritam brahmani vayurme prani shritah prano hridaye hridayam mayi aham amrite amritam brahmani suryo me chakshushi shritah chakshur hridaye hridayam mayi aham amrite amritam brahmani chandrama me manasi shritah mano hridaye hridayam mayi aham amrite amritam brahmani disho me shrotre shritah shrotragum hridaye hridayam mayi aham amrite amritam brahmani apo me retasi shritah reto hridaye hridayam mayi aham amrite amritam brahmani prithvi me sharire shrita shariragum hridaye hridayam mayi aham amrite amritam brahmani ushadi vanaspatayo me loma sushritah lomi hridaye hridayam mayi aham amrite amritam brahmani indro me bale shritah balagum hridaye hridayam mayi aham amrite amritam brahmani parjanyo me murni shritah mudha hridaye hridayam mayi aham amrite amritam brahmani ishano me manyau shritah manyur hridaye hridayam mayi aham amrite amritam brahmani atmama atmani shritah atma hridaye hridayam mayi aham amrite amritam brahmani punarma atma punarayuragat punah prana punarakutamagat vaishvanaru rashmi bhirvavridhanah antastishtatvamritasya gopah.
Thank you so much, Shalini, for reminding that we are not just a drop in the ocean, but an entire ocean in a drop. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
And to complement that audio, now we'll have a short video that introduces the work of Swaram and Aurelio. I guess we can also play the video later. And yes, again, the themes that we are exploring broadly today are how may we deeply listen to our own music, Nada Brahma, and how does one integrate the various aspects that seem to be in apparent conflict with each other, like art and social action, spirituality and business in one's life without being torn too thin? And what is the secret sauce to human unity? And it's a privilege to be exploring that with Aurelio. And so one of my sparrows tells me that a few days ago, there was a gathering in Oroville and Aurelio came to attend it. And there were some lamps and small decorations in the center. And without missing a beat, Aurelio goes out, picks some leaves and flowers, then comes back and arranges them, and making the centerpiece even more beautiful, even more aesthetic. So Aurelio, have you always been this kind of kindred spirit? What was your childhood like?
I think I had the fortune of growing up in nature. And I want to take just a moment, because we connected so beautifully in the present moment today, in the evening, wherever people are. I think in the meeting digitally, what is very important, that we also connect consciously in the different spaces which we are. I think that we have such an opportunity to have a global connect. You know, people would be here in India and maybe overseas. And I think what this is helping us, this online streamings, that we become aware that we are present together in different locations simultaneously on the planet. And so I'm just having this awareness of it, that wherever we are, we're connecting, we're making this network of kindred spirits, basically globally together. I think I had been fortunate to grow up in a natural environment. It was on an edge of a small town in Austria. My grandparents lived, actually, they were farmers and they lived in the countryside in a beautiful hilly side with snow-capped mountains in the background. And I think nature is inviting for participation. When one sees things growing and sprouting in the springtime, and coming into fruition in the summer and into bloom, and then everything withers away and dies and goes underground. And in the Alps, then the ground is frozen for 3 to 4 months. And I was growing also, I had a period in my life, I was growing my food. I think when one comes into the cyclicity of nature, one becomes humble. One becomes excited with the springtime, one flowers with the summer time. So I think one touches all the different planes and parts of the being in a very harmonious, fluid way, because nature is unpredictable, especially now, maybe because we influenced it so strongly with our human, maybe industrial civilization. So nature is even more unpredictable and more heavy in her impacts and messages. And I think the role of us as humans is, I think we are that part of nature which is slowly becoming conscious, so that we can participate in the co-creation, in the evolution of nature, hopefully joyfully and actively.
Thank you. From that stillness, you went probably into a space of restlessness at 19, as Rahul was introducing you. You were an accomplished musician, a guitarist at 19, but you didn't want to rest on your achievements. You were looking for something that came from a deeper source. And would you mind expanding on that restlessness that in that time?
Actually, I had a crucial experience of a very surprising kindness when I was about 17. I was hitchhiking in Austria in the winter. I just set out on the road. I wanted to explore. I wanted to meet the unknown, the unexpected. And so, you know, in the winter, it can be like minus 10 degrees and standing on the road maybe for 5 hours and waiting for a car, because it was very conservative at that time, Austria. And maybe possibly I had long hair, so I was a little bit kind of like unknown. And then after freezing, you know, really freezing through my whole body, a car had stopped, and actually it was not Austrians, it was people from Korea. It was Korean immigrants to Austria. And for me, that opened a complete view, because basically they were so amazingly kind and welcoming, whereas my own country people, kind of like in one way, they didn't care, or that's how I interpreted it at that time. And then that Korean family, they took me home and hosted me in their home and served the meal and all of that. And for me, that basically, it opened this interest into Asia, into what's there in other parts of the world. If my own people, if there was no communication, and maybe if I was judged because I looked different and I behaved different, but those people from a foreign country, they were so open and welcomed me. So that basically really churned something for me. It was so deeply touching, you know, because I overnighted with that family. They were so kind. The next morning, they brought me to where I had to be and all of that stuff. And so that basically, there was a strong call out into the world to explore the world. And actually, because I had a sense that something in the society where I grew up, you know, in the post-war development and rebuilding and all materialistic orientation. So I was a bit disillusioned, and I didn't feel that heart space. And then I looked actually for a place which was furthest away from Western civilization. And it was a tiny little dot of an island in the middle of the South Pacific Ocean. And so it was a little bit the search of lost paradise. But then, admittingly, when I arrived in paradise and everything was kind of like ideal, you know, from a dream of all Western people staying in Bora Bora, in a South Pacific island under palm trees and the white beach and the turquoise blue lagoon and all of that, there is where the restlessness actually really became apparent. Because I was looking for something. I think I was searching for this lost paradise. And that brought me even through staying with lots of indigenous people into Stone Age life in Papua New Guinea. So I stayed some time there in villages with people. And at one point, a little bit later on, so I moved 5 years around the planet. It took me 5 years to return to Europe. It was one big circle. And in the 80s, it was possible. There was not much money, so I had to hitchhike, ride, get rides on boats and jump on trains and whichever way we traveled, walked a lot, and kind of like running away from university. But I always said I studied the universe. My college was the universe and the planet as a whole. So I got a deep sense, taking 5 years to come one time around the planet, I had a beautiful sense of the diversity and the magnitude, the size and the beauty of the planet. And at one point when I came back and I settled and had my farmhouse, then actually I worked with a teacher and he said, there's no way to go back. That's how they say, you can, that's a sentimental journey to go back to nature, go back to the origin, grow your own food, weave your own clothes, spin your own things, make your own soaps and everything. He said, we have to look into the future. We have to leap ahead into the future. And that's actually where the vision of Sri Aurobindo came in through some writings, basically, where he painted, maybe really the future of the human species, where it could go. And so that's, I think, where my, as you said, restlessness or my search really was kind of like funneling in one direction. There's somewhere where we can achieve something which is ahead of us, because I had this deep sense that as we were and with the mess we created on the planet, we couldn't be the crown of creation. There was something more to which we as a human species could evolve.
Yeah, and most of us are living in search of resource. And at 19 or even at 17, you were searching for the source. And I see this resurgence of the number of people that want to go back from the resource to the source. And you're talking about leapfrogging into the future, right? And that early, like you're talking maybe 30, 40 years ago, it's fascinating. So you started exploring the world by exploring your inner world. And in that you found Nada Brahma. So what does it mean to listen? What comes up for you when anyone says the word listen?
You know, because I'm still in this movement of the journey, I think the concept of yatra, any outward journey is at the same time an inner journey. When we go on a pilgrimage, basically, we're making this pilgrimage to come to the source or to the center of the heart. And you see, because the Western, in my perception at that time, the Western society was very much focused on doing. It was all because we went through two world wars and it had to be reconstructed and everybody tried to create a material base for life. But meeting the contemplative traditions of Asia, there was an emphasis on being, on listening, on being receptive. Yeah, being receptive to what is. And again, I think there nature plays such a beautiful part because you know what, one can sit on a river for an hour if one is in an observant mood and in a receptive mood. There's no boredom or something like this if we stay alert. And I worked in different schools. I stayed in Buddhist monasteries in different countries, and I traveled with the Sufi masters through a whole of Europe. And there was always an emphasis on listening. And you know, initially when we say, let's have a moment of silence, it's like, what's happening in that silence? Where are we going in that silence? Are we united in that silence? Do we find a direction in that silence? Or are we just going into nothingness? So I learned basically that in most of the contemplative traditions, listening is the key. And so there are many different stages. Luckily, like in many areas, India harbors so many of those ancient traditions and practices. So Nada Yoga, that branch of yoga, which is focusing on listening to the inner source, is a very elaborate, even if so esoteric, practice, but I had the good fortune of meeting some people who introduced me into deeper listening.
Wow. And you practiced just one tone for a whole year.
Yeah. You know what? I think that's the Indian tradition has so many treasures, and maybe being inspired also by Sri Aurobindo's writing on the foundation of Indian culture, we kind of like believe into the renaissance of Indian culture and the place of those ancient practices. And I just read it in a book on classical Indian music that the traditional way of learning, understanding nada, was to practice 1 year on one sound. And I lived in the mountains in this beautiful isolated hermitage, so to say, without electricity. And it was a good place to do it. So in the morning practice, I mean, I had some introduction already in Vipassana, so I knew how to basically focus and concentrate and empty the mind. And on the base of that, basically, I practiced with one sound, Om. And you know what? In that practice, of course, one goes through different stages. You get bored. You want something happening. There's no experience. But in that way, it's important in practices to have a companion, you know, to share your practice. And in the tradition of Nada Yoga, the best companion is the tambura. So I had a tambura from India, and then you have that friend with which is always there on your side. And that friend is not kind of like going into emotions and different states. The tambura is always sounding as she sounds.
Beautiful. Aurelio, can you please sing that one sound Om for us?
You know what? I have a ektara here, which is another very amazing symbolic thing. You know, it's used mostly in the Baal tradition, and the Baal tradition is a beautiful living tradition of the mystic devotional bhakti song culture of India. And for instance, in that ektara, it means it has one string only. Now, you don't even see that string, yeah, because it's subtle. The nadi is a stream of vibration, but what you have on the ektara, you have Ida and Pingala. You have the duality. That's basically what it is, that ektara represents the spine, so to say. And in the middle, if this is balanced, and if we find a balance between Ha and Ta, between sun and moon, then Sushumna can sound. And she sounds. So what I want to invite maybe this, the people who are sharing in that space, what we can do, because there's a, let's say Nada Yoga is receptive and you listen to the sound and you go deeper and deeper into that realm. And then the second part of the sadhana is Swara Sadhana, where you bring that sound, that contact you had, you bring it into expression. You express the Swara. And the simplest and most essential practice, and maybe the most powerful practice in Nada Yoga, is in Swara Sadhana, the foundation of it is humming. So for instance, I want to invite everybody to see the power of Nada Yoga, because when we say, let's have a minute of silence, you know what, 100 people do 100 different things in that silence. With our mind, and maybe we are with Anapana, we can connect with the breath, which is very helpful. But when we humming, basically, we're creating a vibration, and with that vibration, we can focus our consciousness. So I'm inviting everybody that we just do a bit humming on that sound and connect our consciousness into a service space. With the humming, if we can join that hum with somebody who might need our service, with a living being, yeah, or with some circumstances. It can be even a global circumstances or some challenges of which we are facing, each one in their own way. Let's just do some humming, just for a minute, and with that hum, serve. Be in that compassionate space of being there for someone in need or something in need.
Beautiful. Thank you, Aurelio.
Thank you, Aurelio.
Wonderful experience.
And
sometimes it just feels like to.
I don't hear. Like I don't hear her.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that beautiful immersive experience. And one needs a matching silence to resonate with a matching sound.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, you say it's basically. How to say, it's also the, you know, humming and sound can be a beautiful introduction into silence. Because if you're consciously resonating, then in the silence, basically, the atmosphere is there, you create that atmosphere. So that's, I think, why sound came so important in my life, because I had been sitting long retreats, I had been in silence over months, sometimes in the mountains, and silence was always, sound was this beautiful entrance into silence from any activity. Sound immediately focuses. And then actually after 1 month of silence and not speaking, you know, it's quite difficult to come into the expression again. And for me, actually, there was always this longing. Can we not actually, after a month of silence, it would be much nicer to tone together than to go immediately into speaking language and grammar and concepts and thinking spaces.
This sound being an entrance to silence, is that why at Swaram you make music out of the way brooms brush against the floor or the way hands rub against the stones? You're bringing the extraordinary into the ordinary. How do you do that?
I think we had the gift of over the last century in Western music also, you know, music flowered into this amazing construction and palaces of composed sound, so to say. And maybe with the deconstruction of modern music and the avant-garde movement and some of the pioneers like John Cage, who was a very deep Zen practitioner, those pioneers, they made us aware of sound, of everyday sound, that it's not only in music that we find solace and comfort and inspiration and encouragement, but actually that the listening awareness, once we dive deeper, is bringing us into presence with every sound. So I think, you know, I come from a school basically of listening. It's connected in Vienna. I was very fortunate to an ancient classical school, which goes back to Pythagoras, to the Greek tradition. And it was a school of listening, a school of being receptive and listening to, let's say, listening to outer sounds, listening to our thinking, listening to our breath, listening to subtle energies, listening to the unknown, listening into nothingness. So it goes basically from the gross physical manifestation into subtler spheres. Yeah? And the journey of listening, I think, so I go through life as a listener. Yeah. And I was just recently, I was in an awakening circle on Wednesday evening here in Auroville. There's a circle actually since 11 years. I was not even fully aware. I had an idea of it, but when Nippon was here, I had joined it. But I joined it recently, and it was in an apartment. And then in the silence meditation, you know, they had all the fridge running. There was a washing machine running and all those machines. And I'm not used to it because I stay in the forest basically without any machines. And I heard all the overtones and the music and the machines. And I said, oh my God, how can people, is anybody listening to it? And I think that's what it does. You know, we specialize in one thing and we become more sensitized. But the fun is with listening, the journey doesn't stop. It goes subtler and subtler. And what is really silence? Is there something like complete silence? Definitely not in our creation, in the creation of duality, where matter and all the particles basically play with each other. Silence is always, there's an underground of sound. Sound and silence is like almost like a couple of it. No, I think it's two different sides of the same coin.
That's beautifully said. And maybe that's why the noise of the world doesn't seem to bother you, but inspire you. And you seem to find like great joy in connecting with people, and the work you do in villages around Auroville is quite inspirational when I read about it or learn about it through someone. And most of your employees are actually school dropout kids, right? I want to understand, what is the nature of this inner bridge that connects the meditator in you and the artist who wants to reach out to people in these ways?
You see, everything that moves, has a sound, has a frequency. And so looking at the origin, what moves, what is it that moves? So for me, that this is what, let's say, to say it in a wide concept, this is the Shakti. It's the creative force which moves. And she moves in everything. She very apparently and beautifully and harmoniously and primally and instinctively, she moves in nature, and she moves also in human nature. So for me, I think there's this deep interest also. Of course, it was a challenge for many years. I rather wanted to stay in deep meditation and in inner worlds. But I think I realized after having stayed 6 years in isolation in the mountains that we as a human species, I think we are a species of communication, yeah, of interchange. We are here to be together, yeah. That's one part, because in being together, learning together, we evolve. We face our challenges, we face our limitations. I thought in the end of my 20s that actually, I thought I reached kind of like a touched into enlightenment. And then you come into society and then you face all the challenges and you see that you're still angry and you get upset by things and all of that. And so I think I'm deeply at the same times I learned, it took me quite some time, I think maybe after only in my mid-30s, that I really opened into humanity and the beautiful dance and interaction of it. And I had always this question, why is Auroville, which was created as a place for the future of humanity or preparing a laboratory of evolution, why is that place set in this primal ground of Tamil Nadu amongst the villages here? And so I basically went into anthropological studies and worked since almost in the first years when I arrived here. I said, you know, all these Western idealistic utopian spaces, they can become also mind spaces. And then all my interactions with the local folk were heart-centered. Mm-hmm. And so that had a strong attraction for me. And I think actually Svaram really benefits from this, what we say in our development work, we spoke about the co-evolutionary process. We might be in different spaces, and when you had been working in Silicon Valley, And then you come back into Tamil Nadu, rural Tamil Nadu, and we're on different places and different stages of our evolution, but we're moving together. Yeah, wherever we are. And I think that's one of the secrets when we can bring, when we're aware that we are there for progress and learning, then wherever we are, we can bring and share those gifts. So for me, maybe I brought all the philosophy and the knowledge and the mathematics of sound and musicology and ethnomusicology. I brought my academic knowledge into it, and that the rural youth, basically, they brought their talents, they brought their skills with their hands, they brought their willingness to be and to serve and their sense of adventure. And for me, it became most obvious when the rural youth, and we had gang fights and alcoholism and violence problems, when they worked together with international volunteers which come to Auroville, which were the same age, and I saw those two, there was this amazing peer learning process. Those young people from the West who were college students and finished their baccalaureate, and the local folk who didn't even finish the fourth standard of school and stuff and couldn't read and write, but they bonded so strongly. And I said, here is a key for human unity. We are meeting on an essential plane because our heart space and the emotions surrounding, the emotion dancing around the pure heart, basically we're all the same. When we are sad, we are the same, no matter what education we have. When we are in delight and when we are sad, we as humans, we are one family.
Wow. Yeah, it's not so easy to come to that. I think along the way, you talked about emotional challenges of the real world coming down from the mountains. Can you touch upon like once a challenge? For example, I learned that I think in 2006 or so, there was a fire that gutted down most of the studio and even your computer and your records. What was going on within you at that time? How did you deal with it? Did you see it as Shakti moving through objects, or how did you look at it?
Okay, so you're well informed about all the different stages of the work. You know, of course, then when fire is coming, then it's the fierce aspect of the Shakti. Then it's Kali is striking. And Kali is usually striking, I'm saying it metaphorically, when there is a need of a swift transformation. You know, when that power aspect is coming in. And at that time, I had actually definitely, you know what, I had one mentor who was a very well-known social development worker and a Vipassana meditation teacher at the same time, Bhavana. She was a pioneer in Auroville at that time. So I went through her mentorship. But in the work, you know what, one can make many mistakes. Yeah. And so one mistake that we think, you know, from the West, we think, oh, we know what's good for everybody else. You know, we know what will be the cure for all in all the developmental challenges and all of that. And so I had, I've been a bit, lots of energy and enthusiastic. And in that enthusiasm, I did do some mistakes and possible blunders and all of that. And the fire actually came to be because we took care of lots of circumstantially schizophrenic, mad young people in the village. And then I found out from the doctors in Chipman in the university clinic, they said, you know, chemically maybe they are okay in their brain chemistry, but life is so difficult for them and life is such a trauma. And I'm facing those traumas over the last 20 years, you know, suicide and murder and decaptivation, and women's home abuse, you know, when the women come to work and they're beaten up so that they cannot even look at you on Monday morning and things. So in all those challenges, basically, where's the core of it? So it needs basically also, it needs that grounding. And I think that was a gift for me of Auroville. That fire was definitely grounding us. And I had the good luck, actually, that somebody was coming from America and they had those huge bushfires in the community. And he brought a film and it said, catastrophe as opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So it was even one of those young schizophrenic persons, he had put everything on fire and he stood there with a big bush knife and threatened to kill me. And I walked up to him and I said, listen, what do you really need and all of that? So it was a very powerful situation. And that crisis where our project, which was funded internationally for the first 3 years, basically funding was finished. We were in the next phase of development. We were down in ashes, which was very important because basically at that time, we morphed from a supported project into creating a sustainable base, because I wanted to give up with, and then those people whom we had started the project, they said, no, actually you picked us up that time from the street and we don't want to leave it behind it. Now we are supporting it. Mm-hmm. And so in one way turned around that those young people actually inspired me and they said, we're not giving up. Let's do it together. That grounded the project and it made us actually really strong because we learned to work from nothing. We had to really work very hard for another 5 years to establish ourselves. And that, I think, created the foundation so that Svaram now is almost in that niche field where we are. It's almost a global brand.
Yeah. And working hard seems to come easily to you. And I have a related question. How do you balance sustainability and growth and being a global brand with installations at airports and important places like sound museums? How do you balance that scaling and the sanctity of purpose as you have grown?
I think at the core of sustainability is that inner human being. Yeah, and so that's for me the parameter. That means even with the team, as you said, how big projects can we take? When are we overstretching ourselves? And can we again and again return to that center and middle ground? I think so that's a bit the measure out. And for often for many people who work professionally, it's almost health, you know? Many people who work in the social field, I had to go through 2 major burnouts. Oh, in this last 30 years in the field also. And then you learn from it. And you know, once you hit bottom and you're so, it might take you 3 months, you know, to stand on your feet again. And from those experiences, one learns. And I think I feel we are blessed in our work, in our teamwork, that we, at the core of what we are doing, everybody knows we work with music. What is music for? Music is there to bring harmony into life. So we said, if this is at the core of the work, how much can we bring this harmony in the work processes? How much can we bring it into the team? How much can we bring that energy into, as for instance, in a business contract? You know, can we stand true to the inner core of our being in that one? Are we compromising because we have a possibility of a good deal or something? And I think there that the gift is really of having sound all around us, having those constant reminders of harmony. And one expression of harmony is balance. So we zoom ahead, we work on big projects, international, we overdo it. I'm risking completely. I said, yes, we can do. And then we make the biggest tuned wind chime in the world, 16 meters, 1,000 kilos of tubular bells and all of that. And then I realized what a stretch it was. And it became a 2-year project. And we didn't even know the ways what it all entails, electronics, electromotors, because it wasn't an airport and all of that.
Yeah.
But then in the course, you see, nature has its seasonal cycles. And I think it's also important in work to realize that there are cycles to work. In the summer or something like this, there's a flowering, there's double the energy, and then there's a bit of a retreat. So what we do, for instance, to stay in sync with the cycles, we honor every new moon with our team, because, you know, the Tamil traditional society runs along the moon calendar, like Magari months now, there's very specific things which one can do and not do. And in some months, there's all the functions and everybody's absent. So I think for us to mark every new moon with a puja, with the team, and see what's there. And we have a special prasadam in that month. We know what are the qualities of the month and what's happening. I think our balance, we strike a balance in a seasonal context, and the balance between business and, let's say, in the summer, it's more quiet. In the summer, we focus on research and education. We have evaluation period, and out of the evaluation, we realize where we need to improve. And then we use 2-3 months for education and innovation. And then the time is changing into August, September, and there might be Christmas. That's when the Western foreigners come and the business rises up. Then we have a strong push of working. And then in the season, when people from all over the world are here, it's all about programs, servicing, interchange, inspiration. So I think that what keeps it balanced. It's a seasonal cycle.
Yeah, the seasonal mapping is fascinating. But if one really thinks about it, it is just, again, tuning back to the rhythms of nature. And thank you for sharing that. I have a kind of a speculative, silly question. Let's say, you know, there's a room and it's full of people, and everyone is laughing, and everyone is laughing at different frequencies. If I'm in that room, I still sense total harmony. So I want to understand, like, what is this harmony that is not bound by physical characteristics of sound?
Very good. It's a very good question. You know, one of my foremost teachers and forethinkers of music into the next centuries, he was actually an American-French astrologer, philosopher, musician, Dane Rougier. I don't often mention his name, but I do it in this context. He spoke about dissonant harmony and syntony. That means because, you know, often in the spiritual journey, when we enter the spiritual journey, we want everything harmonious. We want to see everything from a colored, a pink, spectacles and the whole world. That's a little bit the pitfall and the shortcomings of the esoteric scene. We enter that spirituality and think everything has to be as we want it. You know, we set our intent for the aims we want to gain. But life in duality, I think basically we are here on the planet, in this embodiment on Earth, as a learning journey. A journey of growing, of integration, of as evolution is moving. You know, we move through different stages of evolution. And in the field of duality, there are always challenges. There are, as strong as the sun is shining, so many shadows are there. The shadows become actually intensified when you have a strong sunlight, no? And the stronger the light becomes in the inner being, the stronger also we become aware of the shadows. And I think the whole journey of towards harmonization is actually we become more and more harmonious the more shadows we can integrate. Those places where we are not aware, which are not in the light, when we integrate them, we become more full. So what your question on in a room, or for instance, I sometimes when I'm in a public place and let's say in a coffee house or in an auditorium before something starts, you have this like hundreds of voices. I'm just sitting back into that listening mood. And for me, it's like it's just the sound of an ocean, you know, on a gravel beach or something like this. I listen to the music of it all. Yeah. And there might be so many different mind spaces and different communications. But I think the deeper we go, at the core of our being, there's oneness. We are connecting into the oneness quantum field or whatever one calls it. And so it's the same in healing work. You know, we're using sound. We do quite over the last years, basically, we really specialized in I had some initial training in music therapy on University of Salzburg. And basically, we moved into sound healing work, working on one-to-one, working in groups. I had worked for a few years in Quiet Healing Center as a therapist. And initially, also one just wants to harmonize. You know, when somebody comes and you want to comfort him and you camouflage the problem, actually. So it's like to avoid facing the shadow, it will not heal us. Yeah. So that means even in every substantial healing process, it's usually we are facing the traumas which we brought with us through different circumstances. And only when we face them, when we honor them, when we give space for the disharmonies of life, yeah, and when we learn actually how we relate to them, then we can come into this larger harmony which integrates dissonances.
Wow, thank you. Thank you for teaching us the trick to convert every coffee house into a meditation space. I also want to remind our viewers that you can type your questions in the chat box of the live stream, or you can also email your questions for Aurelio at this address, ask@servicespace.org. Thank you. And Aurelio, to pick up that thread of shadows, and you spent considerable time with Acharya S.N. Goenka from the Vipassana tradition, and all holistic systems see our return to the source or return to health or well-being, whatever you may want to call it, as a process of cleansing our body and mind of impurities. And you were touching upon how Nadi Yoga helps one with this ignorance and suffering. Can you expand a little more on that?
I think the base, and I think that's the gift of Vipassana meditation, is samatha, equality. No? That we face whatever we are encountering in life, that we face it with a certain, Goenkaji always spoke about equanimity. Shrabindo speaks about equality. Because maybe equality is actually, equanimity is almost like you have to face it, you are still active. But equality is actually, I mean, as I interpret it, it's a poise. One is stationed in that space, yeah? And how to say, even in listening, as you said, how is that working in the Nada Yoga space? Many of meditators, and I went through these stages for many years, actually, you know, it was perfect when I was sitting in the monasteries or in my mountain abode. But as soon as I, let's say, after a month's retreat, I had to go out on the highways and freeways and come back or something like this, travel through the cities, I couldn't bear the onslaught of dissonant sounds and noise, basically. The noise, as we define it, is disorganized sound. Yeah, tonal structures, they are proportionate, mathematically ordered configurations of sound. Yeah, so how we deal with the chaos? That's noise is chaos, basically. No, how can we integrate the chaos? And it's the same, basically, in the listening process again and again, because the nice thing is in the listening process of Nada Yoga, we have actual happenings to which we can refer. Usually sound is coming from physical sources, yeah? And then we can test ourselves how to say, of course, I prefer to listen to a beautiful Beethoven sonata or some music, meditative music. And then I have those machines running. I have a chainsaw right next in the next garden of my neighbors and stuff like this. And I have a version to it, yeah? So there it's basically the same process of how we come, what does it mean to be in a state of samatha? Yeah? And have this, what do you say, non-judgmental attitude toward sounds. And I think it's almost an easier exercise to do it with sounds than when you do it with thinking processes. Because if you sit in a meditation practice and you experience all the beautiful things, you know, then one has it, everything is okay. And one develops an attachment to it. But then when actually all these disturbing thoughts are coming, so how you deal with it? And thoughts are much more subtler frequencies and vibrations than sounds from the environment. So you can say almost that Nada Yoga is, can be also used as an immediate practice towards Samatha. If one has, I mean, I feel fortunate I had that foundation, and Vipassana is a very amazing foundation in the practice, because Samatha seems to be the foundation for any spiritual practice.
Thank you for sharing anchoring that you have in equanimity or samatha. That brings me to a related question, which is in Indian classical music, right? The classical music was not focused on using musical scales for entertainment or even enjoyment, but to tune oneself. And the focus was squarely on the idea of bhakti. Can you speak about your
respect? Sorry, if you can. Yeah, you can. We had a little break. If you can repeat the question, speak about.
Yeah. You were speaking on equanimity, and I think the Indian classical music was also focused on that. So, for instance, there was no focus on using musical statement or enjoyment. The focus was only on the idea of mukti through the expression of these sounds, maybe through bhakti, maybe as a chant, right? And do you resonate with this idea?
So you see, actually, I think that's important now that we actually come to the concept of integrality. Because, you know, so many Westerners, and I think even Indian people who return from the West or who grew up, I had this image of Indian culture that it's solely focused, and like Indian classical music, that it was focused on the process of mukti, of liberation, you know? And mostly mukti means actually getting out of this, of the mess, you know, piercing the veils of Maya and kind of like going into somewhere else. The question is actually, why would we be embodied if we just want to get out of it, no? And if we want to leave it behind. So I think this is so important and that's my association also with the service space, because we are basically here to embody, to act, to do, to give, to be together, yeah? And so basically in the integrality, there's a, in the integral yoga and Sri Aurobindo's records of yoga, there's a beautiful, concise formula, which I think brings very beautifully across actually the concept of integrality. The first part of it is, it says just shuddhi, mukti, bhukti, siddhi. Yeah. So as you said before, the first process is purification. We have to dismantle and get rid of and transform all the conditionings we bring with us through the life circumstances, through our growing up and all of that. That's a process of shuddhi and purification. And naturally, we all have a tendency towards the source. That's how we started our conversation. You know, there's a knowing of the oneness source, and there's a longing to be with it and be connected. So that's the process of mukti, of liberation. But at the same time, that took me maybe, I think, more than half of my life to realize we also have a very strong attraction to enjoyment, to life, to creation, to beauty, to interaction, to communication, to love, to communal beauty and happening and coherences and all of that. So that's actually we honor it and we recognize it. This is bhakti. You know, it's based on bhoga. We are here for enjoyment. That was one of my discussions, one of my final discussions with Goenkaji. Because I said, sir, you know what? It looks like all of the practice is going into Nibbana, into a no man's land. But I'm associated and I'm in artistic work, in cultural work, in human development work, and all of that. And it tears me apart. Am I going into kind of like Nirvana, or am I active in the world? And so I think for me that was so important. And he really completely encouraged me, because he knew about that I'm staying in Auroville and follow Sri Aurobindo's basically his vision and his seeing. And he had a big laugh. And he said, nothing wrong with doing all the beautiful things and to being creative and working with children and all of that, if it is on the base of non-attachment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically, if we are in this process of purification and we follow our natural levitational urge into oneness and find it within, and we basically also come into manifestation and are in the bhoga of it. That's the polarity to yoga and bhoga. And roga, we transform through the shuddhi. And then actually we can achieve siddhi. Yeah? Then we can achieve this perfected being, basically who is here, who is in the world and with the world, but also not of the world.
Wow, and I would like to do some questions from the audience now. And there's Kishan from Maitri Space in Ahmedabad asking this question. One of the expressions of harmony is balance. I would love to learn, what are the other pertinent expressions?
Yeah, balance is a beautiful image of harmony. But harmony is actually also integration, what we spoke before. I can be in harmony when I'm in peace with all the elements which are surrounding me. Yeah. Another factor maybe of harmony is coherence, that I feel like whatever is happening, everything is connected. There's an interconnectedness with everything. I think an important factor of harmony is also humility. That we actually, how to say, we realize we're only a part of it. We're only a particle of this whole thing. We're only one cellular organism amongst this whole expression of the whole organism of Gaia. Yeah. So humility, I think it's not like I cannot create that harmony. I'm part of it. How can I feel that? That ocean in the trop, now which with this beautiful chant which we had started. Mm-hmm. I think also harmony is a journey. It is not a fixed state. It's a process. Harmony is evolving. I'm speaking actually, I used to say I'm standing for harmony. This is my life's cause. But then I realized there's so many processes which are not harmonious. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so progressive harmony, it's not a product. Harmony is not a product. Harmony is a journey.
Wow. And we have another question. Jayanti in Koyambedu. Can music heal me even if I consciously do not have an aptitude to understand that music?
That's a beautiful question, because that's the magic of music. Music in certain stratas of the Brahmanical society or the Western elite society, music goes through the brain. You know, when we are kind of like, we perceive the classic music, we know which rhythm is working and all of that and which melody structures are there. But the beauty of music is music not only works directly into the heart, into the emotional vital being, but music works musical vibrations, and that's why we're working with the elements of music, which is sound. Sound works directly on the physical. So even if I have no understanding of music, the musical waves and frequencies have a direct impact not only on our emotional body, but also on our physical body.
Wow. Thank you, Aurelio. And there is this question from Anchal. How can one attune oneself and make that inner voice prominent so that the outside noise doesn't shatter that inner voice? And how to find that inner voice and build its resilience? I think maybe you can talk about some of your practices here that can help.
Yeah. Let's say I'm able to do my, 10, 12, 14 hours of work daily because I have also 2-3 hours of inner work. Yeah. And I think that's crucial nowadays in this intensive time, of which humanity is facing, is that we do have an inner practice. Yeah. I was very inspired. I had been with many teachers whom I considered really very special and enlightened beings. And each one of them still was in their practices and took a retreat every year and all of that. Yeah. So, but again, music is so accessible and sound is so accessible. And we had a little exercise here. The best way and the simplest and most effective way in attuning oneself is humming. And maybe I'm speaking easy about it, but yes, that's what I did for 1 year, and that created a very thin foundation. I had to continue, and I'm continuing daily to be in this practice of first listening, of emptying the vessel, yeah, being with what is, yeah, without reaction, without attachment to it, and then from that on, then see what is inside and connecting to whatever that is, and if I don't hear it, I'm humming, I'm teasing it, I'm inviting it with my hum. And in my hum, I'm finding it. And the beautiful thing is I can do that as a morning practice, I can do it as a practice before, even when I'm lying already, but I can do this practice even in a train, in a transport, in an elevator. Yeah, I can do it in so many different circumstances. It won't disturb anybody. So humming, one of the foremost pioneers in sound healing worldwide, Jonathan Goldman, he produced like maybe 25 CDs on chakra sounds and the angel sounds and all of those things. He is now in his mid-70s, and maybe that's his legacy. Actually, he wrote a book on the humming effect, bringing in all the science, what humming is doing, what is happening in the neurotransmitters and all of that. But okay, if we need to satisfy our mind, having the scientific background, but we know from the Indian tradition that in every breath, there is a sound, you know, in every in and out breath, there's this basic mantra of soham there. And I have a chance to connect with that. So humming, I think, is possibly one of the most essential practices and will become more and more practical and dominant, I think, for humanity in this challenging transition.
Thank you. That's so beautiful. And there is a curious question from one of our viewers. It reads, Aurelio, I see a candle lit next to you. I would like to understand why it is there.
I had lived for many years without electricity, and I think it's a gift because in the candle, in the flame, basically, there's life. There's this life energy, and this life energy is rising. It's ascending. And I had worked for many years with the Vedic hymns to Agni. That flame is inside. That flame is the flame of aspiration and enthusiasm and creativity. And for me, a flame, for me, it's something essential. Like I lived on a running stream. Yeah. So the sound of water is the descending sound. Yeah. In some practices, in some sound healing practices, in some Sufi practices, we work with running water. We even create the sound of running water. Sometimes I even kind of like I have a bucket and I let water drop into that bucket. And just as there the pulse, the regularity of a water drop. Yeah. And the flame, it's brings me in touch with the mystery of life.
Wow.
And it was just this morning, actually, I had it in my morning practice. I had a candle there and oil lamps. We're using ghee lamps and oil lamps. A candle was easier to transport. And I said, hey, I think it's important also now in these online spaces that we manage to share our life, our truth, and not that we just become human busts and we see some fractions on a small laptop camera and stuff like this. Is how can we bring beingness into our global togetherness through the digital media? So that's why I thought maybe that would be an idea to bring a flame into it.
Very thoughtful, thank you. And from the mystery of light, can we move into the mystery of sounds? Aurelio, would you be moved to offer us an immersion, maybe 3 minutes, 4 minutes, whatever comes up for you?
Okay.
Yeah. And with that,
we can... Okay. I have, it so happened that I found at home, there are three bells. They are actually from a horse cart in Austria. You know, the horses are pulling these sleighs. They have bells. And when I found this old thing for the horses, it was like a collar, a horse collar. I was so surprised that those bells are tuned. So I said, this is what the old tradition did. They even tuned the bells for the animals. Yeah. What I want to share, maybe it so happens that we have those instruments here. It's a gift from the lockdown. The lockdown actually in our community enterprise, and we work with 45 people, brought that we could really order our work, we could reflect upon it, and we could listen deeper what wants to emerge. And one thing which emerged was this planetary frequencies. We have them in different sizes. I have this little here. There's one frequency. There's another one similar. So we have those little sound chips. We have sound arches. And we have this elliptics. Yeah. And let's say those sounds, basically, they are tuned according to planetary orbits around the sun. I have the orbit of Guru, of Jupiter here. There is Mars, and there is the orbit around the Sun. And they are not necessarily in harmony. Mars is going its own way. Yeah. So what I just for a few minutes, I invite you, we listen to those sounds. And basically, when I play that, I connect to the quality. Let's say the quality of Jupiter is a little bit overseeing what's happening in the inner part of the solar system. Yeah, he carries wisdom and perspective and goodwill. It's this goodwill shining blue planet out there. Yeah. Then there's Mars, which is more directive, and there's a willpower in it. Yeah, there's an activity, an urge to do something. And somewhere in between, the Earth is trying to find its balance, and it finds its balance of constantly staying focused with the sun. So we have the three images. How to say, we're traveling around the light, we're focused on the sun, we have an impetus for action, hopefully for service action, and there is a coherent space of wisdom around it. Yeah, so those are the sounds, and I initiate them and close them maybe with the Austrian slate bells, jingle bells. So I just invite you into a listening space, connect with your breathing, connect with your body, with all the cells in your body, connect with the images which are there for you, an image of a focus on a central light, on will, power, action, and the wisdom coming out of that. letting the resonance of the sound merge with your breathing, with the sensations in the body, and with the space around, and the possibility of sharing some of that positive, wholesome resonance with some of your dear ones in need. Whenever we connect and generate some energy, the possibility of sharing it. Sharing metta, metta bhavana. Sharing it with the whole humanity, one humanity on one amazing, beautiful blue planet.
Deep gratitude, gratitude for that. Thank you so much for being with us today in these ways where you opened your heart and you opened your studio for us. And that in turn led to our ears and hearts at many levels. I would like all of us to invite all of us into another minute of shared silence to end this talk. And before that, I state out my wish, just like Aurelio stated out his wish. May we all go from the thinking mind to the seeing mind, and may we all go from the feeling heart to the unified heart. And most importantly, may we all go through life as deep listeners. And that is the gift that Aurelio has given us today. Thank you so much for this. And I thank all the participants for being here, enriching this talk. And a huge bow of gratitude to our Awaken Talks back-in team, which has put this together in this way. Thank you so much for the sanctity that was generated here today. And now we'll have our moment of silence and leave in silence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.